So the temperature measures your obviously resting metabolism. And after ovulation is when you produce significant amounts of progesterone. Progesterone has a thermogenic effect on the body. So that's what causes your actual baseline temperature to rise.
Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. The show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. We're Kristen Cornett and Dr. Haley Nye, your hosts and the creators of the online fertility platform, Tiny Feet. This episode is brought to you by our online preconception and fertility optimization course, Fertile in 5 Masterclass. This course walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy so you can get pregnant when you want to, stay pregnant, and bring your healthy baby home. With over 6 hours of video lessons, printable worksheets, and quick reference guides, and links to all of our top recommended products and resources, Fertile in 5 really lays everything out for you in an easy-to-follow step-by-step program. If you're ready to stop stressing over getting pregnant and feel confident and empowered on your fertility journey, then this is the perfect solution for you. To learn more, click on the link in the podcast episode description or go to bit.ly/fertileinfive. And if you'd like to get a free sneak peek at the full course, check out our mini course on how to choose the best prenatal supplements, which actually walks you through step 3 of Fertile in 5 Masterclass. You can get signed up for the free course through the link in the podcast episode description or by going to bit.ly/prenatal supplements. All right. Thank you all so much for tuning in today. We're a holistic nutritionist and naturopathic doctor, and our passion is helping couples get pregnant naturally and have healthier babies. We started a virtual practice through Tiny Feet, where you can schedule one-on-one consults to investigate your health and get your fertility on track. And we also offer online courses. You can learn more on our website at tinyfeet.co. And if you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can find Dr. Haley at Synergy Women's Healthcare. To learn more about working with her in person, visit synergypdx.com. You're listening to episode 55, where we have the pleasure of welcoming fertility awareness educator, Fertility Friday podcast host, and author Lisa Hendrickson-Jack to the podcast to talk about the logistics of tracking your menstrual cycle for fertility. We had Lisa on earlier this year in episode 26 to dive into the wonderful world of cervical mucus, but in this episode, we wanted to talk more about how you can actually go about tracking your cycle and why this can be such a helpful tool on your fertility journey. Tracking is something we recommend to clients all the time, and we definitely see some of the hangups and misconceptions women have about using fertility awareness. So Lisa is going to share some of her amazing knowledge and hopefully help you all feel a little more comfortable with getting in touch with your body in this way. We also spend quite a bit of time at the beginning of the episode talking about hormonal methods of birth control and how these medications can potentially have long-term effects on health and fertility, and most women are simply never informed about these risks before starting birth control. We start to really dive into the cycle tracking discussion about halfway through the episode. So here is a summary of what you're going to learn today. We're going to talk about why it's worth giving fertility awareness a try and what you can learn about your body through cycle tracking. Why having a regular menstrual cycle with monthly ovulation is an important indicator of health and wellness. How hormonal birth control actually works and why it can be problematic for cycle health and fertility. Misconceptions about fertility awareness and why it's really not the time-consuming, painful process you might think it is. The logistics of tracking your cervical mucus and basal body temperature and what these parameters can tell you about your fertility, and how you can use Lisa's book, The Fifth Vital Sign, and her companion charting workbook to get started with tracking your cycle. This is definitely a packed interview, so let's introduce you to Lisa and get started. Lisa Hendrickson-Jack is a certified fertility awareness educator and holistic reproductive health practitioner who teaches women to chart their menstrual cycles for natural birth control, conception, and monitoring overall health. In her book, The Fifth Vital Sign, Lisa debunks the myth that regular ovulation is only important when you want children by recognizing the menstrual cycle as a vital sign. Drawing heavily from the current scientific literature, Lisa presents an evidence-based approach to fertility awareness and menstrual cycle optimization. She hosts the Fertility Friday podcast, a weekly radio show devoted to helping women connect to their fifth vital sign by uncovering the connection between menstrual cycle health, fertility, and overall health. You can find links to Lisa's work, her books, her website, and podcast on our website through the link in the podcast episode description. We hope you enjoy the interview. All right. Welcome back to Mastering Your Fertility. Lisa Hendrickson-Jack, we are so excited to have you back to talk a little bit more about fertility awareness.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah. So we had you on the podcast quite a few episodes ago, probably about halfway through the life of the podcast so far. And you gave us a little bit of background on you at that point. But for listeners that are new and maybe have not listened to your podcast, Fertility Friday, before, why don't you just give us a little bit of background on you and what got you into working with fertility awareness?
Sure. Well, I'm an author. I'm a certified fertility awareness educator. And I've been teaching women to understand and interpret and chart their menstrual cycles through fertility awareness for nearly 20 years. And I started in this work because most women, I didn't realize that there's only a small window of fertility each cycle. And when I discovered that, and I discovered that I could use that information to avoid pregnancy without hormones successfully, that really changed the way I looked at everything. And it even changed how I looked at my body and my periods. It made me look at them in a much more positive way because I understood them. So it was really profound. And then what prompted me to start the podcast and write my book was more of a feeling that I had the responsibility to share this information with other women. So in my life, I had been able to take this information for granted for, you know, so long. And when I looked around and saw friends of mine and acquaintances really struggling to conceive, and underlying all of it is just no one knows anything about their cycles or fertility, how it works. So I really felt the need to do my part to bring this information into the light.
I love that. And, you know, doing that through such an incredible book. So you wrote The Fifth Vital Sign, which I believe came out, was that earlier this year? Now I'm all...
Yeah, beginning of January or mid-January.
Yeah, it's such an incredible resource. And you did it so thoroughly, you know, you researched it so well. I think you had like over 1,000 research citations in that book. It was really, really amazing how much science you brought into that, but also how understandable it was to somebody who's maybe never learned any of this information before. It's just such a great resource for women.
Yeah. It's definitely really something that I recommend to my patients and have, you know, several books on my shelf to be able to either lend out or tell them to go buy. It's just, I like how easy it is to read. For somebody who's, you know, a busy mom and have very little time in my schedule, your book was one of the books that I was just flying through because it was so easy to read and understand, and it made so much sense. So we appreciate the resource.
Well, thank you so much. Huge compliment. And I think now that we've met and I've had you on my podcast and we've had a lot of opportunities to talk, I write how I talk, and it comes from all the years of explaining to clients, to the women who I've worked with. So it's helpful to know the questions that people ask and to know the areas that they struggle with so that you can figure out how to talk about it so they get it, right? So that's where it all comes from.
Completely. Yeah. And there are quite a few areas that people get tripped up in when they're tracking their cycle. And that's kind of what we want to cover today, just because this can be a little bit daunting. You know, I have found myself more and more recommending to women to track their cycle. A lot of them are using just kind of the apps that tell you, okay, you started your period on this day, so you're probably going to start on this day and you probably ovulated on this day. And that is not fertility awareness. That's basically the rhythm method, which right. is not the same thing and not nearly as effective. But I just kind of want to ask you this, and I'm sure you've answered this question a lot, but for those that are really struggling with the idea of tracking their cycle, why is this important? Why should women be more aware of what's happening in their menstrual cycle?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm trying to think of how to. So first of all, even though I fully teach fertility awareness and use it, I don't necessarily think that it's the right thing for everyone in terms of using it as a method of birth control. I think that that's why we have all these options. You know, women are going to gravitate to what makes the most sense for them at that time in their life. And so there's obvious benefits for the women who do gravitate to a non-hormonal method of birth control. So women who potentially have, you know, not had a good experience on birth control, or who just in general are at the stage of their lives where they're trying to minimize their exposure to artificial hormones. So one of the obvious benefits then would be having a non-hormonal method of birth control that you can actually rely on. And so you can preserve your fertility and just enjoy the benefits of being in your own body, your normal hormone production, and also, you know, choose to either become pregnant or not based on what you want. Outside of that, so even though I don't necessarily think that every single woman is going to choose fertility awareness as their birth control method, I do think that every woman has the right to just a general sense of body literacy. So understanding the general, like how your cycle works, how ovulation works, what the different changes are, what a normal period is supposed to look like. And the reason why that is important is because if you don't understand how your body works on that basic level, it really limits what you perceive to be your choices and your options. And when you understand that there is a certain level of normal and you can identify if your cycle is normal or not, it also gives you just more insight and more power and control over your options. When you understand that your cycle is a reflection of your health, then you can, I feel like it's just really important for us to then be able to advocate for the care that we need. So when women don't know, they're not really able to go to their doctor and ask the questions that need to be asked or make the choices that need to be made. We're more put in a position where we just have to accept whatever we're told, take whatever medication, because we really don't know any other alternatives.
Right. Yeah. I know another really important reason too is when you're on an oral birth control pill, oftentimes it stops ovulation, or it's like a forced menses that actually isn't really a menses. And I know Dr. Laura Bryden is a big advocate for this too, of this fact that women need to ovulate. It's part of our natural cycle. It helps create this natural progesterone at the second half of your cycle, and it protects our heart, it protects our bones, it protects our brain. And it's a very important part of being a woman and being healthy and preventing long-term chronic disease later on in life, which unfortunately that's not being told to women when they're young, in their late teens and being put on birth control pills for many, many years.
Well, we're kind of sold this idea that, and I think it comes from the history of medicine and science. The study of medicine and a lot of the history of science is based on the study of the male body. And so I feel like we're sold this idea that we're like men, except we have these other parts. So it's like, my analogy
we're
is
so
like,
not
right. Cause we're not. But so if I go to the car dealership, I can, you know, choose if I want air conditioning or not, you know, but that isn't gonna, if I get it or don't get it, it doesn't change the engine. Like the car is still gonna work. So we kind of have this idea that our ovulation and our reproductive system is kind of like that. Like you could just shut it on or off and it doesn't have any impact on the rest of your body.
Right.
And that's the lie that we're being taught. That's what happens when you go to the doctor and it's like, my cycles are totally irregular. I don't know what's going on. And the doctor says, well, that doesn't matter. We'll just put you on the pill and that'll regulate your cycles, quote, air quotes, regulate, AKA shut down ovulation and give you, withdrawal bleed every 28 days so we can all feel better about ourselves. And then when you want to get pregnant in the future, just come back and we'll get you ovulating. So there's no understanding that, as you said, ovulation is a crucial, it's just part of our human bodies. It's a part of like a biologically female body. And progesterone and estrogen, the two main hormones that are produced based on our ovulatory cycles, are not only related to reproduction. So even if you never have children, you still need to produce estrogen and progesterone in your cycle. Those hormones are related to the normal development of our breasts, and deficiency or, you know, imbalance of those hormones can be related to breast cancer. It's related to the normal development and growth of our bone structure. So when you take a teenage girl and put her on the pill, before she has matured and reached her peak bone mass, which happens in our 30s and sometimes even later than that, it's possible that she may never reach that peak bone mass because the pill prevents the normal development of her bone structure. We know this.
Right.
This is, I'm not making this up. This is in the research.
No, it's in the research.
Exactly. Well, and that's just unfortunate because a lot of women who are seeing providers that are prescribing birth control, that's not necessarily their wheelhouse, you know, digging into a lot of this research and really helping a woman understand what these hormones are important for in her body, aside from just the ability to ovulate and become pregnant. I really hate that phrase, quote, regulate your cycle. That just, like, it drives me bonkers because it's completely crap. Like, that's not at all what's happening. And we know that that's not what's happening. I mean, when we develop these drugs as pharmaceuticals, we understand what the mechanism of action is.
Or do we? So that's an interesting point. Because when the pill was first created, the creators, they were looking at it kind of as if it was mimicking the female cycle. So arguably, they stumbled upon something that suppressed ovulation and prevented women from getting pregnant. But arguably, they didn't necessarily know exactly how it worked when it was very first, when they first stumbled upon it.
But we do now, and we're still sharing that same phrase with women, like, oh, we're just going to put you on birth control to regulate your cycle. Now, of course, at the time when you have men discovering this, like, yes, I can see how that might have been. We might not have had the full understanding of what we were doing when we placed a woman on birth control, but we do understand that now, and yet we're still using that same terminology, which is confusing and certainly doesn't help a woman understand her body any better, and that just frustrates me.
Well, and when the pill was first developed, so the first iteration, like the beta test version, they gave women these hormones consistently, and the women just stopped getting their periods. And so they all became convinced that they were pregnant because this was the time before the pill, you know, in the late 50s. So the pill came out in 1960. So there was no precedent for this. The only time that, a mature biological woman would stop menstruating is when she would be pregnant or there was actually an illness or something like that, or menopause, that would prevent her from menstruating. So the women actually then would become very upset when they realized that it was a drug that was making, because they really did think they were pregnant, so they were devastated in the whole thing. So when they created the pill, they purposely created it to mimic the woman's cycle. And so that initial reason for doing it has still permeates our language and the way that we talk about it. And to this day, the vast majority of women who take birth control don't recognize that it's not a real menstrual period that they're getting. Because that's not how it's presented.
Right.
And so that's a huge problem just to understand how it works. So for anyone who doesn't really know how the pill works, there's three main modes of action. One is to suppress ovulation. And so by interfering with the conversation between the hypothalamus and the pituitary and the ovaries. And so essentially shutting down normal ovarian function. And when you do that, your ovaries are not producing the normal levels of your own natural estrogen, progesterone and testosterone, and the hormones in the pill are not estrogen and progesterone. They're synthetic. So we're getting, it's just, so I think that's the first thing. And instead of having a cycle, it's shutting down your cycle and basically giving you a chemical, you could refer to it as a chemically induced menopause if you want.
Interesting.
Yeah. That is.
Because, so what happens is we often are told these lies. So these white lies. We're told that the pill mimics pregnancy, and we're told that the pill mimics, so the pill makes your body think that it's pregnant, basically. But when you're pregnant, your natural hormone production increases immensely. The amount of natural estrogen and progesterone that you produce is completely different. When you're on the pill, it's really shutting down that ovarian function. So your actual natural hormone production is very kind of stagnant. And that is the only state that is similar to a natural state is actually menopause. Because in menopause, you stop ovulating and then you produce far less of those ovarian hormones.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't understand that hormonal production is kind of a negative feedback loop. You know, when you have enough, your body says, okay, we're going to shut down production. So if you're getting all of this exogenously, your body's going to be like, okay, we have something that looks enough like estrogen or, you know, progesterone that we don't need to produce our own.
Exactly.
which is why so many women have issues when they come off of birth control. And we've definitely talked about that before on the podcast, having interviewed Dr. Jolene Brighton about that very subject, because your body can take quite a bit of time to readjust to producing its own hormones. And, you know, some women have semi-permanent alterations in the way that their cycle functions, after, especially after spending long periods of time on birth control. So,
well, and that, I mean, that applies pretty directly to testosterone production.
Yeah.
You mentioned how your body responds to this influx of these exogenous synthetic hormones. And one of the ways that your body responds to that, so not only are you producing way less testosterone because you're shutting down ovarian function, but your body responds by producing increasing amounts of the hormone sex hormone binding globulin, or the protein sex hormone binding globulin. And so women on the pill have anywhere from 50 to 60% less testosterone than women who aren't on the pill. I think it's important to point that out, the physiological changes that happen when you take the pill. And it's important to acknowledge that it's important that the pill does that for the function. We're using it to prevent pregnancy. So suppressing ovulation is very helpful when you're trying to prevent pregnancy. So that's why it works. I think it's important for us to understand why it works. But when you think of side effects, you think, okay, well, some women are going to experience side effects, some women aren't. But we have to make that difference between, okay, what's happening physiologically? All women on the pill are going to have 50 to 60% less testosterone. How that plays out will be different. Some women will have experience depression or anxiety. Some women will experience low libido. Some women will experience painful sex. And some women won't really report anything. But the physiological effects are there for every woman who's on it.
Right.
Super important to be aware of.
And then when you come off the pill, oftentimes there'll be a rebound effect with testosterone or androgens. And that's where a lot of the acne comes from. Or if you don't get your period back right away, you have this kind of post-pill PCOS syndrome happening.
Well, I think one of the areas of research that was, it wasn't surprising, but it was super disturbing, was what I always say is that when you're trying to find information, you have to kind of look where the money is. So I ended up looking at, I wanted to understand if the pill had an impact on the ovaries. And so in order to find that research, I ended up looking into studies where they were actually looking at fertility preservation. So that's when a woman is actually trying to freeze her eggs. So what would happen is, if a young woman wants to do that, she has to come off the pill in order for them to stimulate the ovaries and get the eggs. So if she would come off the pill and they would try to stimulate the ovaries right away, they would get far fewer eggs and just much poor result. If they had her wait 6 months, then it would actually improve. So they measured ovarian reserve parameters. They measured ovarian volume, so how big the ovary is. They measured anti-Müllerian hormone, and then they also measured antral follicle count. So what they found was that women on the pill shrinks the ovaries. The ovarian volume would be 50 to 60% less.
Wow.
So this is a physical thing where it actually would shrink the ovaries. And I've heard, so I'm not a surgeon. I will never see ovaries like in real time, but I've heard surgeons talk about this where, oh yeah, if a woman's on the pill, yeah, her ovaries shrivel up like little almonds. Like I remember hearing like a very offhanded, obviously not good bedside manner comment from a surgeon. And that's what prompted me to think, okay, does it have an effect on the actual ovary? So when you're talking about the transition phase from when you come off the pill to what has to happen in order for your body to normalize, you know, there's no evidence that would suggest that this is permanent. So whenever I say like, okay, it shrinks the ovaries, a lot of women get really nervous because like, will they ever go back to normal? And there's no evidence to suggest that it doesn't. But what those studies showed us was that it took an average of 6 to 7 months post-pill for those ovarian reserve parameters to normalize. So the researchers then suggested that, okay, if you're doing fertility preservation, you'll want to come off the pill 6 months, you know, or so before you do your stimulation so that you can actually get more eggs. Why are we not telling women who want to get pregnant the natural way that it would take 6 months for their ovarian reserve parameters to normalize? So they should at minimum take at least 6 months. Like, right? Why would we not?
Well, what I was just thinking is like, so when I was younger and I was taking the pill, probably in my young 20s, is even if you miss like a day, you're like totally freaked out that you're going to get pregnant. And you have no idea that, like, even if you miss the day that was like a day before your sugar pills or whatever, you're still just like, oh my God, I'm going to get pregnant. And there's no education, I guess, fear-based whatever is like the best, you know, contraception, because you're just like so on top of taking your pill. But we don't teach women. Yeah. They think that the moment that they stop that pill, they're like super fertile and that there's just going to happen that next month. And for some women it does. So obviously you need to be careful, but for a huge majority of women, it just doesn't. And this is part of the reason why.
Well, and see, it's important to really flesh that out, because, you know, as a fertility awareness educator who teaches women both sides, birth control mm-hmm. and trying to conceive, it's important to understand that pregnancy is possible in any cycle where ovulation occurs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the challenging part, though, is to what we're not taught as women, what I feel like is one of the biggest missing pieces, is that we're not taught how our fertility changes with time as we get older. We're not taught about the different transition phases that our body could go through. So if you're on the pill, what the research tells us is that there's no evidence to suggest that the pill has a permanent negative effect on fertility, but there is an established temporary period of subfertility post-pill, and it's well documented. And so it's studied in different ways. So one group of research, say, looks at the ovarian, or not ovarian, but the menstrual cycle parameters. So there was one study that I looked at where the women, they had a group of control women who had never been on birth control, and then they had women immediately coming off birth control. And they looked at all the different parameters. They looked at total cycle length. They looked at, you know, cervical fluid production. They looked at luteal phase length. So they just looked at all these different factors. And on average, it took anywhere from 9 to 12 cycles before all of those parameters normalized. So before, when you're looking at the data, you can't really tell the difference between the women who never took the pill and the women who took the pill. And 9 to 12 cycles is not 9 to 12 months, because some women don't get their first period back for, say, 3 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. So 9 to 12 cycles in real life is more like 12 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And that's what you see. If you actually were to look at the charts of women who come off the pill, the first few cycles, often the cycles are longer, so it's taking her longer to ovulate. She's often having a shorter luteal phase, like it's taking her body time to adjust. She's often not having normal mucus patterns. But by the time you get to about a year post-pill, then we're starting to see the mucus patterns normalize. We're starting to see the luteal phase lengthen to what it's supposed to be. We're starting to see the average cycle, the cycle length normalize. And so what it is, the way I look at it, it's like understanding the concept of insurance. So we all know that some women come off the pill and get pregnant right away. We don't always talk about how 100% of pregnancies don't end in live birth. So there is a higher risk of miscarriage immediately post-pill that we don't talk about. But we do know that it is possible to come off the pill, start ovulating 14 days later, and absolutely getting pregnant, and that's it. So that is a possibility. What we don't talk about is that if a woman has been on the pill for 12 years, she's not 20. And yeah. Our fertility changes with age. So from a statistical standpoint, the other type of studies that look at how the pill can affect fertility, like the time to pregnancy studies, what they find is that from a statistical standpoint, if a woman is taking the pill, it takes on average twice as long for her to conceive versus a woman who was on a non-hormonal method. So whereas, like, if she was using condoms or something, on average, it's taking four months to conceive. For a woman who just came off the pill, on average, it's taking 8 months to conceive. If she was taking the shot, an average of 18 months to conceive. Mm-hmm. So that is the part that we're not being taught about. So yes, it's possible to come off the pill and get pregnant right away. But when you're planning for your future, as women, we spend a lot of time planning for our weddings. We spend a lot of time planning for our careers. We have to be given the information so that we know, you know what, there mm-hmm. is a transition period. It could take longer. So my recommendation might seem crazy, not to your audience though, right? But I would say that when you're coming off the pill, give yourself at least 18 months to 2 years. Wow, that's a long time. But this is insurance. Because mm-hmm. you don't know. And some women, so especially what the research tells us as well, is that if you were put on the pill because you had irregular ovulations, irregular cycles, or you weren't cycling at all, you're at a much greater risk of not having your cycles return in a timely manner. And that's not because the pill caused that. It's because you had an issue before. The pill doesn't solve that issue. The pill was simply masking that issue. So whatever was going on that was not making you ovulate normal is still happening. So especially for women who were put on the pill for those reasons, because some women come off the pill and they don't get it back for years. It's very rare. And obviously the pill doesn't cause that, but the pill was masking it.
Right. Yeah. All of that is so, it's so important to understand. I love these conversations because it just really highlights some of these things that women just have no idea. Like the majority of people don't have any idea. And the only reason that they start learning a lot of this stuff is because they come off birth control, things don't return exactly the way it's expected to. And, you know, a lot of times they're just getting like, oh, well, if you want to have a baby, let's just use fertility drugs or whatever. Like there's just, there's not a basic understanding of what might be happening and, you know, how we can use the tools that we have, you know, now holistically to investigate that further and find out what might be happening. So I think that's a really good transition to actually talking about tracking.
I actually have a quick question because I'm ruminating on it as you're talking. So we've talked a lot about the oral birth control pill, but there's this big transition into young women, especially millennials, that are getting IUDs instead. And there's non-hormonal IUDs like the Paragard, and then there's also the hormonal IUDs, which typically just have progestin in them, meaning that they don't have estrogen or synthetic estrogen in them. What are your thoughts on that and like how that affects the menstrual cycle and fertility?
I think with all birth control methods, we have to be provided with the accurate information. I think that with the hormonal IUDs that have the progestin, women are often told that it's a low dose and it stays in the uterus. Like all that kind of stuff is really weird to me because we have a circulatory system. So if I put lotion on my skin, and it has a chemical, it's going to go through my bloodstream. So the thought that you could have a progestin impregnated IUD put into your body and it's just going to stay in your uterus is actually just a flat out lie.
Yeah.
So I think, first of all, we just have to understand that in order for any type of hormonal contraceptive to work, I mentioned the one main action of like the combined oral contraceptives, which is suppressing ovulation. So with the progestin only IUDs, so it does not always fully suppress ovulation. So I think one of the points to clarify, because you can look at the research around the progestin releasing IUDs. So basically women who take them fall into different categories. Some women do continue ovulating fairly regularly. Some women ovulate, but more sporadically. And some women don't ovulate. So the main modes of action then for the IUD, because how could you not get pregnant if you're potentially ovulating, is to thin the endometrial lining. So when women have that progestin releasing IUD, the uterine lining is very thin, so thin that a pregnancy can't happen. Mm-hmm. And also it's causing your cervix to fill with a thick mucus plug. So that's how it works. So I think that the good thing about that option is that, you know, some women do continue to ovulate. So at least you are getting some of those natural hormones and you are not getting the estrogen, like the synthetic estrogen. There are some women who can't have that. You know, if they've had developed a blood clot or something like that, they can't have anything with estrogen. So it does give another option. But at the end of the day, it's still hormonal. It's still having an impact on your endocrine system. Some women respond very poorly. Some women, so the side effects of depression, anxiety, you know, some women experience irregular bleeding. Like those are things where we just have to understand what the side effects are so we can make those decisions. And if we experience them, then have the option to kind of move on.
Yeah. So we could use fertility awareness method or like tracking our cycle to actually see if you have an IUD, if you actually are ovulating month to month.
See, I think with the progestin releasing IUD, it's a little bit more precarious. So it's certainly possible if you do, but I would say more so with the copper IUD. So when a woman has the copper IUD, there is no hormonal aspect to it. So then you would continue to have your menstrual cycle. You would continue ovulating. Many women will track their cervical fluid. They'll track their ovulation. They can still take their temperature. I would say it's possible, but not for every woman, because some women on the IUD don't ovulate and some women ovulate sporadically. So it really depends on how you're responding.
Right. Especially if you have the copper IUD, but you weren't ovulating before. I mean, that's really going to just continue, right? If you have more of like a PCOS type of picture, then.
Well, yeah. Like, because the copper IUD is not going to fix or change your cycle. No. So it's just whatever your cycle is, it's just going to continue happening. And so with the copper IUD, it's interesting because I mean, the mode of action is that it causes some degree of inflammation, localized inflammation inside the uterus. And also the copper is thought to have some spermicidal properties. So the challenge with the copper IUD, so some women have it and it's amazing. If you had heavy or painful periods prior, the copper IUD typically makes it worse. So women will report an increase in their bleeding and also potentially an increase in pain. And some women have kind of random uterine contractions and discomfort throughout their cycles. But at the end of the day, it's the same with everything else. As long as you have an idea of what it could be going in and all the side effects, then you know, and then you can make that decision. And many women have a very positive experience with the copper IUD. One of the things I think is interesting about the copper IUD is because it causes some degree of localized inflammation, when studies have been done where they actually look at your hormone levels throughout the cycle, they look at the progesterone levels in the luteal phase, often they're still a little bit off. So I think it's not enough to deter anybody from using it. But I'm just a big proponent of informed consent. So it's interesting to know that it can actually impact the luteal phase a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's still far better than being on a hormonal birth control option that's going to suppress ovulation entirely, because you still get to have the benefit of your natural estrogen and progesterone when you are on the copper IUD.
Yeah, perfect. Good. Thank you so much for clarifying. I hopefully that's helpful to the listeners. I know it's helpful to me.
You're so knowledgeable about all this stuff. It's so tempting to just like pick your brain all day long about all this stuff. But I really do want us to talk a little bit about some of the logistics behind tracking. And the reason that I really wanted to do this episode is because I find that this is coming up a lot with clients. It's these like little pitfalls or these misconceptions about like how much time this actually takes, how difficult it really is. So I guess the first question I really want to ask about fertility awareness is, what are some of those like objections or less than accepting feelings that maybe women have about this when it's first suggested to them as a way of either preventing pregnancy or just tracking for fertility purposes?
Well, when I think about where those objections come from, I think the first thing that comes to mind is often how doctors will dissuade their, so when women are saying, oh, I think I want to do this, all the things that they'll hear from their practitioners. So there's generally this idea, and I don't know if it's like a cultural thing, where we kind of hesitate and shy away from fully educating women about their bodies. And there's kind of this idea that it's too complicated, it's too hard, it's too difficult for her to figure out. And so often, you know, doctors or other medical care providers will have this kind of idea that it's too difficult and, you know, you should just stay away from it. So I think that is, at the end of the day, with fertility awareness, women who choose to do it are self-selecting. No one's forcing anyone to do anything. You know, no, you can't force someone to choose fertility awareness. So the women who choose it are the ones who want to do it and the ones who are inspired to take this type of approach. So it's not too difficult. Most women who learn fertility awareness will feel after anywhere, depending on if they're working with an instructor or not, after anywhere from 1 to 3 cycles of actively charting and understanding and seeing ovulation, seeing all the different parts of the cycle and how it works, and then having your period come, most women really get it quite quickly in terms of just the general idea of it. Of course, there's the argument that it's too time consuming and that it's too much. But what I found is that it's like any other habit. So if you can brush your teeth every day, probably twice a day, then you can chart. Because at first, there's always a bit of a learning curve. At first, you got to get yourself into the habit of checking your cervical fluid. You got to get yourself in the habit of waking up and taking your temperature. And if you choose to check your cervical position. And then, you know, once a day, you got to enter that information into your either your app or if you have a paper chart. But for most women who chart, I mean, this is when I'm working with a client, I'm encouraging them to do external wiping as a way to check their cervical fluid. So you go to the bathroom, and here's the thing, you know, everyone who's listening went to the bathroom earlier today and will continue to go to the bathroom later on today. And so you're already doing the actions. We're just now adding, we're just doing it consciously now. So, you know, when I'm talking to my clients, I'm not like telling them to go to the bathroom more often. I'm just saying, when you're there, let's just check for the cervical fluid. In the morning, getting in the habit of taking your temperature. And now there's tons of devices where if that is prohibitive for you, you can actually, you know, stick a device on your arm that'll measure your temperature and, you know, send it to your app. So there's a lot of just aspects of people kind of discouraging women to do it that are really just rooted in the fact that they don't themselves do it. So in their mind, it's like, oh, this is so complicated. But ask someone who actually does it how complicated it is and how time consuming it is. And they'll tell you that they're just in the habit and it's just something that they do now.
I don't find it to be complicated or time consuming at all. And I actually just recently started paper charting. So I had an Ava bracelet for a while that kind of tracked, but I just didn't feel like I got, I don't really feel like I got as much data from doing that, from using that, as I did from actually tracking my own temperature, doing my own cervical fluid, and paper charting. Like, I hate paper. I don't like my handwriting. I don't like the process of having to write things down. But I was like, you know what? I'm really going to try this paper charting thing. Like, I really want to see how that feels for me and how much more information I feel like I might get from having to do it this way and not rely on technology to tell me about my body aside from the thermometer itself, right? Like, so let's talk a little bit about like procedurally. So a lot of the objections are, oh, it's too time consuming. Women aren't smart enough. It's too difficult. Like, none of those things are actually true. Another argument is that it's not effective, which is, you know, if you're doing this correctly, it's quite effective. And it's quite effective, not just for birth control, if you're choosing to use it that way, but it's also very effective for identifying the fertile window and understanding your cycle. It's very effective for that too. So like, just procedurally, how do women take their temperature? Is this really that big of a thing? Like, how do they do it?
Well, I mean, it's not that big of a thing. I think I always share with my clients, there's the ideal scenario and then there's real life. So when you're taking your temperature, ideally you would have at least 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep. So you're taking it before you, like, first thing in the morning or whenever you wake up, before you get out of bed, before you get up and go to the bathroom and all that kind of stuff. Because what you're trying to measure is your resting metabolism. So you're trying to get a measure of your body at rest. And, you know, in terms of the thermometer, these days it's super easy to get a thermometer that measures to 2 decimal points, but really the minimum requirement would be to 1 decimal point. The 2 decimal points is like a cherry on top, but you don't really need that additional information. You would just round up or down, just like math class. So 0.5, like if it's 97.82, you would round it to 97.8, 97.85. Mm-hmm. You round it up to 97.9. And I am actually saying that because I get that question a lot. And yeah. There's women who get kind of stuck on some of those details. So yeah, getting a thermometer that measures to say 2 decimal points is pretty straightforward. What I recommend that initially a lot of my clients find to be a little bit annoying is to hold the thermometer in place for, you know, at least 10 minutes. So the main areas that are acceptable to take your temperature would be axillary, under the arm, orally in your mouth, and some women opt to take their temperature vaginally. I'd say the vast majority of women take their temperature orally. Whatever is clever. And one of the challenges with the Ava that I found is that because it takes the temperature from the wrist, the temperatures are often quite a bit lower than the temperatures if you were to take them orally. So if you wanted to get additional information about your thyroid or something like that, you can't really, like, if the temperature showing up as 95 point something on the Ava, you can't really take that to mean you have a thyroid issue. You'd have to actually do like the axillary or the orally just to get a baseline to make sure before you jump to conclusions.
For sure.
And then trying to think of what else is important. So part of the reason it's important to hold the thermometer is just because it takes, although the thermometers beep right away, they're not, if like you can, so anyone who's listening who has a thermometer and who's done this, you can just do this experiment. So, you know, take your temperature exactly when you put it in your mouth and when it beeps, then wait a minute, and then do it again and again and again. Like do that a couple times. And you'll see for yourself that the temperature actually continues to rise until it reaches to a stable point. And so when you hold, when you actually do that, you're just allowing it to normalize. So what I hear from my clients all the time, every program, every, you know, is that they're initially skeptical. Like, does it really make a difference? Like, this was the one thing I read in your book that I'm just like, Lisa, come on. And then when they actually do it and they see the temperatures, they're just more stable. They're just easier to read and understand and interpret. A lot of women get hung up on, okay, I need to take it at the exact time every day. And I have women who will tell me that they're setting an alarm clock and waking up at 5 o'clock on a Saturday. No, sleep is more important.
Well, let's chat about like, what is the purpose of the temperatures? Because I think that matters as well. Like what are we actually doing? Why are we doing our temperatures? And I have a question for my own personal temperature charting. does it matter to do the temperature while during my menstruation? Because if I'm on my period, like I'm pretty positive I'm not ovulating. And my thought around taking my temperature is to just know when I actually ovulated and, or if I did ovulate, right? And if it was a form of birth control, then I also know when, about what time I'm going to ovulate. And so that's when I don't have sex, or like opposite, right? So kind of break it down for us.
I'll meander. And so remind me if I didn't answer all the questions. So I'll try to get to it all. So the purpose of taking the temperature in the most basic sense is to confirm ovulation. So the temperature doesn't help you to predict anything. So you can't take the temperature to have a heads up about when ovulation is going to happen. So the temperature measures your obviously resting metabolism. And after ovulation is when you produce significant amounts of progesterone. Progesterone has a thermogenic effect on the body. So that's what causes your actual baseline temperature to rise. So because your temperature does not rise until you produce that progesterone, and you don't produce that progesterone until you ovulate, there's no predictive value for the temperature. And I know some resources talk about like possible dip or whatever, but I've seen so many charts and there's no reliable thing that happens before ovulation every time that you could rely on. So that's what it's measuring. And that's basically the purpose. And what you're looking for, I think it's really interesting for anyone who's kind of like a science nerd type person. It's really cool to see this pattern that your body shows cycle after cycle, to have this tangible way to confirm ovulation and to see how your body changes every cycle afterwards. So you're looking for a sustained temp rise. So if you were charting on paper, you would, you know, note all the different temperatures down. And then you'd find that there's a group of temperatures before ovulation that are lower and a group of temperatures that are after ovulation that are higher. And you would be able to then take a ruler and draw a line between the two. And after ovulation, the temperatures wouldn't dip below the line in a typical cycle. To answer your question about menstruation, so, you know, for what I tell my clients is that your temperatures during menstruation are often more erratic because your hormones are kind of going up and down a little bit. So when you do take your temperatures during menstruation, you'll often find that a couple of them are like pretty high, or just they're quite just a little bit more jagged. And so some of my clients will opt to take their temperature anyways because they're in the habit and they don't want to break the chain. So they don't want to like mess it up. Like, I've been really good taking my temperature every day. I don't want to just skip it and then get out the habit. And other clients will just not take their temperature during menstruation and then just pick it up after their period's done. So you don't really need that information.
Got it. Okay. Good to know. Yeah. So we are taking our temperatures only to confirm ovulation, but we're not going to take it to know when to have sex, because by the time it spikes, it's the opportunity is over.
Well, so it depends on your intention. So if your intention is to get pregnant, then yeah, waiting till it rises is not is not the best way to do it, because by the time it rises, it means your fertile window is all like basically over. It means you have already ovulated. So for women who are trying to get pregnant, temperature is helpful to confirm that you've ovulated. It tells you when to stop having sex. And it helps you to then more accurately, confirm the due dates and all those types of things. So that part of it is really helpful. When you're trying to get pregnant, you want to look at your mucus. You want to look at your cervical fluid and have sex when you see mucus.
I think one more really important thing about temperature, which I found with my own cycle and obviously with a lot of patients, is understanding how long your luteal phase is.
Yes.
Because your luteal phase really should be right around 14 days. And if it's less than that, you know, your temperatures will start start to either drop. And so that's a sign that progesterone is starting to drop. And then if you're, you know, obviously if you start bleeding, then in your luteal phase, you can really see just right there on paper, oh, I ovulated here and my, you know, and then I started bleeding here. This is how long my luteal phase is.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the majority of the women that are coming to us for help with their fertility, there's something going on, you know, they're struggling to conceive. And I think that having that information about where you're ovulating in your cycle, you know, is it day 20 and is your luteal phase 11 days? Like, that's something that we need to look at. And that's a pattern that we can kind of address with various therapies and maybe just like taking something out of your life that's excessively stressing you out. You know, that's an indicator of what might be going on, like an underlying cause type of issue that may be causing the fertility struggle. And I just think that that information is really important. And I think it's also important for women to prove that to themselves, like, okay, this is really what's happening in my cycle and I'm responsible for tracking this and bringing this to my practitioner and helping them help me.
Mm-hmm. And well, I think I'll just mention, I mean, the luteal phase is the most stable part. So from the time you ovulate to your period, it's the most stable part of the cycle, but it can fluctuate depending on stress and depending on other issues that could affect your progesterone production.
Yeah.
And so 12 to 14 days is pretty typical. So some women will have 14-day luteal phases. Some women are more like 13 or 12. And really the concern is when we start getting lower than that, like 11 and 10. Mm-hmm. Kind of the absolute minimum is about 11, but an 11-day luteal phase is short. Yeah. And the challenge is a lot of women want to achieve this perfect textbook cycle and really get into these numbers. And I think it's really important to just, for me, I'm always looking at the cycle as a reflection of what's happening. It is a vital sign. So when you're seeing a shorter luteal phase, when you're seeing these things, I would say what's most important is to look for a pattern. You know, if a woman typically has 13, 14 day luteal phases and she's got one cycle where it's like, it shortens to, let's say, 11 days. And then when you're talking to her, she's got all kinds of stuff going on. She just started a new exercise routine. Who knows? There's reason for that. But I would say the more concerning thing is when you have a pattern, you know, when she's been charting for a while and every cycle it's short. I feel like there's some discernment to be made there. Sure. And one other thing with the temperature, just in general, because I know you were like, what's the purpose and what's helpful? Because the temperature is taking your baseline metabolism, then we do want to look at, you know, the temperature. In the pre-ovulatory phase, ideally you'd want to see most of the temperatures falling above about 98.4 Fahrenheit, 37.3 Celsius. And so when they're regularly lower consistently, then you just want to look at the different reasons why it could be. And sometimes it's as simple as you're not getting enough sleep, you're not eating enough food. Sometimes it's something different, like there's actually nutrient deficiency going on. Sometimes it could be something like thyroid, but I think it's just important to know the different ways that the temperature can be helpful.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. So at what point, if a woman is looking at her chart, at what point can she be reasonably certain that she's ovulated? Because it's not necessarily just like one spike where you're expecting it to. Like, I think it's the rule, there's like a certain number of temperatures pre-spike that are considered normal, and then it's like a consistent three. You just tell me what it is instead of me trying to explain it.
Well, so to confirm ovulation, you're looking for three normal temperatures. So temperatures that aren't outliers, it's not because you drank the night before, but three normal temperatures that are higher than the previous six normal temperatures. And so I always say normal and normal in there, because there's a lot of things that can affect your temperature, you know, from the alcohol consumption to stress, to travel, to time changes, to whatever. There's a lot of things that can affect it. And so what is helpful is to keep in mind that if you've charted for a couple of cycles, you'll see that your pre-ovulatory temperatures do fall kind of within a pattern. So you should start to see that if something's kind of higher or lower, like it's out, like there's an outlier. And so that can help you to understand how to interpret that. And what I would also say is that if you're actually charting, you're actively charting, then you'd likely also be looking at your cervical fluid. So your temperature shift should line up with where your cervical fluid either dries up completely or at least makes it a shift from the clear stretchy to either to nothing or to the lotiony. So you should see these things line up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an important point. I mean, these really are meant to be used together. Like, you're not just tracking your temperature and you're not just tracking cervical mucus, especially if you're wanting to do this for birth control purposes. You can't use temperature.
So I'll just point out there that technically temperature is something that you could use by yourself. And in that case, you would just be waiting for ovulation. So right. There would be no unprotected
before that
pre-ovulatory phase at all. And you would just, if you use temperature only, like that is a method and you could just wait until the temperature rises and you confirm it with 3 high temperatures. So you have to wait until it rises and stays high. So, I mean, there are women who use that. There are devices that are based on that. So that is a thing.
That sounds like something that maybe partners would have a slight issue with, maybe. So it could be used that way if you're just waiting to have any unprotected sex until after it rises. But, you know, for the fertility perspective, when we're trying to identify when the best time is to have sex, we really should be using the cervical mucus. And then that temperature is helpful for identifying other things that might be going on in the cycle, especially confirming ovulation, making sure that your cycle falls into a relatively normal pattern. You can use that information to communicate with your healthcare provider. And you can also use that information to determine whether or not something might need a little bit of additional investigation, especially if you're struggling. So tracking's pretty cool. It's great. Like I just have to say, like, my personal experience, tracking is pretty cool. I didn't think that I would enjoy this process when I started it. I was like, oh, it's just, you know, it's something that I'm recommending a lot, so I should probably do it myself and really understand how this works. But I actually like it. I like being able to see what is happening in my chart. It's kind of like maybe it's like a nerding out thing for me, but it also feels like this tool of control that I have to understand my body, because I have a history of a lot of health issues and a lot of this has affected my cycle and my fertility. And it just feels like another tool that I'm using to really understand what's happening in my body and just have another set of observational points that can help me put all of the pieces of my puzzle together. Mm-hmm. So I have personally really enjoyed it. And I have to talk about your amazing charting workbook that you made as like a companion to your book, The Fifth Vital Sign. And so I'd been thinking about tracking on paper for a little while. And then when you came out with this, I was like, it's just fate. Like, and it's so beautiful. And nobody's going to be watching the video on this, so I can't show everybody how beautiful it is, but it's really well put together. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the charting workbook that you made, how you're kind of intending this to be used, and why it's so great.
Well, thank you so much for that. So, I mean, when I'm working one-on-one with clients, I have a chart that I just send to them, like an e-chart, and they can just print it out. So that's free for years. That's what I've been doing. And then they would just print it out and then they would use pencil crayons and their pens and different things just to put in the different notations and all of those things. And I think it surprised me. So, I mean, I started charting in like the year 2000 or something. So there were no options of apps and there were no apps. None of this stuff existed. And so I think there was a part of me that was just like, well, everyone's just going to want to use apps now. But through my practice and through my work, there is a certain percentage of women who just always will chart on paper. And that, as much as it surprised me, is just a real thing. And I still want to chart on paper because I've done different apps and things like that. But at the end of the day, I just like having it on my nightside table and all of that. So, I mean, when it came to creating the chart, I actually worked with a designer to help me to, it's actually kind of funny. I went through one designer before I found the designer that was going to help me, because my vision was like, okay, I know it's a chart, but I need it to be like a spreadsheet that doesn't look like a spreadsheet.
I think you achieved that. I'm like, it's right next to me. I'm looking at mine right now and I'm like, yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah, because it is a spreadsheet, but it can't look like a spreadsheet. It had to be pretty. So that was part of the process. I knew what it had to do, what the function had to be, but I just wanted it to be a nice experience. So it's pink. I printed it, you know, I did it in color and I made a point of it's all in color, right? But so the pieces that needed to be there, what I tried to do is incorporate the different feedback from my clients over the years. So I knew that it needed to be big enough so that you'd have enough space to write down what you needed to write down. There needed to be a lot of spaces that were just not filled in so that you could just make a decision about what you want to track, because every woman wants to track different things. So some women are going to track breast tenderness and PMS symptoms. Some women are going to track their supplements and their dietary changes and their exercise. So I made a point of including many slots that are just up for grabs that you can do what you want. And I tried to make the required slots as minimal as possible. So the things that need to be there. And I mean, because I've also been charting for so long, part of it just comes naturally, like what would need to be. And also you just have to make a call. So there's a few things that are bones of contentions for some devoted charters. So when I did the temperature, the lowest temperature is 97.0 Fahrenheit, 37.0 Celsius, because there's two versions. And I've had a lot of women say, but my temperatures are always 96 point something. They're always lower than that. You know, why didn't you include me? It's a gentle nudge. The temperatures should be within normal range. And so I wanted the chart to be a gentle nudge of that, of if your temperature is always 96.5, it's not supposed to be 96.5. So we need to do something about that. The chart is 35 days. So if there's certain decisions, you just have to call it, you know?
Yeah.
And again, it's a gentle nudge. It's like a healthy cycle should be, you know, within this range. And so you want to know that, like someone needs to tell. Because when I started charting, my cycles were regularly 38, 45 days. And I was like, oh, it's great. I'm Lisa. I've got long cycles. And it wasn't until my charting instructors were like, wait a minute. Your temperatures are too low. Your cycles are too long. You know, let's get your thyroid checked and let's make sure everything's okay. Then I started to really understand, oh, wait a minute. My cycle is a vital sign. It actually is telling me information. And there is a normal. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, there's just certain judgment calls I had to make. One of the fun things that I included in the book was a way to look at, I call it, what do I call it? Like cycle tracking. Let me look at what I called it, because I can't remember. Is that bad?
Okay. No, okay. It's not.
Okay.
There's a lot of information in here. I don't blame you for not remembering every single word that you wrote.
Thanks. Okay. I'm looking at it now. Cycle summary pages. That's what I called it.
There you go.
But basically a way for you to, if you wanted to look at a year at a time. So there's a way for you to kind of note if you wanted to know when your periods were over the course of the year. And I made it open so that whenever you start using it, you can just put it in. You can put in whatever month and day. And then also a way for you to track. Because of course, after you've been charting for a while, you may want to look at how long your cycles were, how long your luteal phases, when ovulation was happening. So there's just a few places where you can summarize that. And I know when I was, all the years that I was charting my cycles on paper, you know, including now, I used to make charts. Like I actually, the first iteration of this book I made when I was like 22, I sold it to all my friends. It was pretty fun. So this is kind of like a throwback for me, because I actually did make a book already like when I was in my early 20s, but I didn't have the ability to make it accessible to everybody in the way that I was able to do it now. And when I made that book, I also had those places where you can just look at your cycle averages and just keep track of those things. And I know for me, it was so interesting to see, you know, the average cycle length and how they would, it would change based on the different things that I was doing. So yeah, it's like my passion project. Super awesome.
Yeah, well, I love the design and the fact that you did, I think you made it as functional as an app in paper form. And there is an electronic version of this. Like if you can get this on Amazon, you can get an electronic version of it. And I was just like, well, I'm just going to try the paper version. I'm just going to do it. But you know, if you want to track in an app, you can. I think that this is a fantastic companion. It also has instructions for how to do all this stuff. So it's not just the charting pages and the summary pages, like you mentioned. There are instructions and troubleshooting. And what if my temperatures are all over the place? Like, how do I troubleshoot mm-hmm. that? There's frequently asked questions in there. So it's a great standalone resource, but it's also a great companion to the book, which is how to the fifth vital sign, which is kind of how it was designed, was to be a companion workbook. So my recommendation would be, if you haven't read the fifth vital sign, get the book, read it, and then do the charting workbook, whether you want the electronic version or you want the paper version, so that then you can put all of this into action when it's fresh. It's like, start mm-hmm. the habit when you get excited about all this stuff. Like, don't learn about your cycle and be like, oh, that's so exciting, that's so great, I'll chart someday. Yeah. And that someday ends up being never. So, you know, just do it. Just start. It's really,
well, we can also kind of like put this all together from the beginning of the episode. We mentioned coming off of birth control up to 2 years before you plan on trying to conceiving. And then you can practice the, you know, unprotected sex or the birth control method, fertility awareness method with the book and all the things that Lisa offers here. And then you'll be a total expert when you're ready to try to conceive.
Well, when I think of kind of like the vision of it, so kind of like it's kind of what it did for me. It doesn't guarantee that, you know, getting pregnant is going to happen immediately and easily, but you're stacking the odds in your favor. And so I really believe that as women, we've really been focused on our ability to choose not to get pregnant. That was like the women's revolution. Like, we need birth control. We need to have the ability to not get pregnant if we don't want to. And of course, that is very important. Yeah. But we also need to have the ability to get pregnant when we want to. That's what we need to preserve. That's why I think that it's so important for us to be fully informed about the birth control methods that we're using. And we need to be informed about the temporary delay in fertility, the fact that it is possible that you come off the pill and it could take a year for you to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it will. But what we all know is that if you come off the pill after all these years of knowing that or thinking that you would get pregnant immediately. I was too scared to go on the pill because I would often forget to take it. And I had read the pamphlet. So when I was starting to be sexually active and I was looking for a birth control method, I was actually too freaked out to use the pill. I was like, no, I need to use condoms because then at least if I'm pregnant, I'll know. Like, I was so scared because I was like, because I was on the pill as a teenager for period pain because I didn't know how else to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And I never, like, because I wasn't using it for birth control, I would often forget and I would often like have to take the two the next day or whatever the case. So going from that mentality of like, oh my gosh, if he looks at me, I'm going to get pregnant, to actually coming off the pill, having unprotected sex and not getting pregnant. My experience has taught me that the first month, we're cool. We're like, you know what? I was on the pill for 6 years. The first month, whatever. Right. But by the second month, you're suspicious. By the third month, you're in an all-out panic.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you get to month 8, month 9, when your cycle's finally normalizing, and when you'd actually be at the stage where everything's kind of getting back to normal, you're already in the clinic getting mm-hmm. IUIs. And I like, so you're already on the fertility train, the fertility mm-hmm. intervention train, but no one is even telling you, like, you know, there's a period of subfertility post pill. So maybe we shouldn't freak out until it's been a little bit longer. Like, no one even says that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, everybody, yes. Everybody kind of pushes that age. That's something that I hear from probably 50% of the clients that I talk to. It's like, well, I'm getting older and I'm really starting to like be worried and I've had all these health issues and all this stuff. And so it's like that age thing is still a really, really big driving factor. And we're telling women like, oh, your fertility drops off a cliff at 35. It used to be 30 and now we're at least telling women it's 35. But it's kind of that panic, like, oh, I need to start these interventions really soon. And I need to get on this right away if I haven't conceived in like 6 months, basically, especially if you're over the age of 35. And that is the time where you would probably want to start evaluating. But if you're tracking and you understand that like your cycle is changing and you have that pattern available, then you know that maybe there's just, your body just needs a little bit more time to normalize as opposed to, I need an IUI or I need to get sent to IVF right away.
Well, so there's a huge difference between coming off of birth control and when you're not, like, so you're avoiding, you're still terrified of pregnancy. So you're coming off of hormonal birth control and whatever you're doing, you're either, I've had clients who've abstained for a little bit. I've had clients who use condoms, but you're still actively avoiding. So when you're in that situation and you can just chart, then you can see for yourself. It's hard. I have the experience and, you know, working with people. So I have more patience because I understand how it unfolds because I've seen it many times. So it's really hard when you're just starting out. It's chart one. And it's like, oh my gosh, it's a hot mess. But mm-hmm. like, if you have the patience, like, it's like, trust me. mm-hmm. But like when you have 3 charts under your belt, 6 charts under your belt, then you can actually look back and see how it unfolded, mm-hmm. how your luteal phase lengthened, how the cervical mucus patterns normalized or how they didn't. And to know that there's something that you need to do. Like if it persists, then you know that there's more that you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that when you're not trying to conceive, when you're not already stressed about the pregnancy, it's just, I don't know, if we have the option, I would just like to, you know, I just want to empower women to give them the choice, you know, and we can mm-hmm. only do that when we have the knowledge.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. I love that. I know that I'm just starting to get into tracking my cycle. I mentioned that earlier, and it's, it's disheartening if you see something that, you know, my luteal phase was a little shorter and I've had a really stressful kind of summer and, you know, I have a little toddler. And so I'm like, okay, all right. The nice thing about it was that it's just right there in your face. Like you can see it on paper, like, oh, stress is affecting my cycle. Like I can see this clearly. And so it's, for me at least, it feels it's the nudge that I really need to be like, okay, pay attention to self-care, exercise, you know, reduce or eliminate the drinking altogether, which I really have. And because that affects our temperatures. I mean, it's just really cool to kind of see it on paper, even though it might be a little disappointing. It's like people who are scared to go to the doctor to get their labs done because they're like, I don't want to see what it comes back as. But you're, but once you finally do it and you're doing it, you can actually see the changes over time. Like you're saying, like I can look back at my cycles and be like, oh, my luteal phase is lengthening. I'm ovulating a little bit earlier. That means, you know, my body is getting healthier, and that's really empowering and motivating to just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lisa. It is a joy to have you as always on the podcast. We appreciate all of these wonderful resources that you have created for listeners. We will be linking to the book, of course, as well as the charting workbook for those of you that are ready to just jump in and start doing it, you know, take the inspiration and just start right away. But yes, thank you so much for your work in this field. We appreciate you more than you know.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun chatting with you. For the listeners, I just want to mention, I've got a freebies page, fertilityfriday.com/freebies. And you can actually see the first chapter, the e-version of the Fertility Awareness Mastery Charting Workbook, as well as the book itself. So there's some goodies over there.
Awesome. Cool. We'll link to that as well. Thank you again, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa. Mm-hmm.